Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, if you have not yet subscribed to my new newsletter, it is Morning Shots, comes out every morning, well, certainly every morning that I write it, and we cover a lot of ground. In fact, this morning's newsletter deals with the conversation I had on this podcast yesterday with George Will about the conservative sensibility and the distinction between conservatism and classical liberalism, including the very small disagreement that we had about whether or not it's time to reclaim the title of classical liberalism, since the left isn't using the L word, so you can listen in. And maybe we'll continue this conversation, because our guest today really completely inadvertently sparked this massive global debate about illiberalism. And it is, of course, David French, the leading advocate for Frenchism, I guess. Okay, so, hey, first of all, good to talk with you, David.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So, I guess my main question, what is it like being David French these days? I mean, to have a thing, David Frenchism. I mean, it's like, was there some morning when Trotsky came down and said to his wife, hey, you know what? There are people calling themselves Trotskyites now. It's a thing.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be a thing. You know, in the 15 minutes of fame of David Frenchism, I think we might be on like sort of 14 minutes and 55 seconds. So I don't know how long this is going to be a thing, but it's been very strange, honestly, because I'm minding my own business on Memorial Day weekend, and people start sending me a tweet saying that there was no polite David Frenchian way to strike back against what turned out to be drag queen reading hour at Sacramento Public Library, a thing that I didn't know existed, and a thing that, quite frankly, I didn't really care to think about all that much. And then it turned into, but I was very interested to see that the argument that there was sort of no polite way through the culture war coming from a Christian, Sohrab Omari. And so I wrote a pretty short piece in National Review sort of saying that there's nothing inconsistent between fighting for your values and being civil and decent while you do it. And in fact, that's a biblical command to be civil and decent while you fight for your values. And then lo and behold, 2 days later, Sohrab writes this extended essay in First Things called Against David Frenchism, which was
against. Yes. So this was not a one-off tweet attacking you. This was he was stewing about it. And this was,
yes,
the entire manifesto, the need to confront Frenchism.
Yes. And, you know, the thing that was really curious about it is it constructed two straw men. There was the straw man version of me, and then there was a straw man version of Donald Trump. And he sort of pitted the two straw men against each other. And if I had read his description of Trump and read his description of me and believed both of them, I would have been against me also. He kind of painted me as this milquetoast libertarian who was extremely meek in confronting the challenges of our time, and then constructed Donald Trump as an instrument of, literally, this is one of the characteristics he ascribed to him, as an instrument of, quote, social cohesion.
Yes.
That was cohesion.
That was heroic, a heroic observation.
Amazing. And so, you know, with these two straw men battling each other, it really was, I thought, there was a little bit more heat than light. But if you strip away all of that, I think there were three main contentions here. Contention number one is that modern politics, the stakes of modern politics are so high, it's better to think of it as war and enmity. That number two, that in fighting this political war with enmity against your opponents, civility and decency are second order values, meaning essentially optional and sometimes not desirable. And then the last thing is that not only is classical liberalism insufficient to meet the challenge of the day, but that classical liberalism is in fact part of the problem, that it has in fact led to some of the cultural decay that we see. And I wrote a pretty long piece responding to all of those arguments, rejecting the notion that war is enmity, defending civility and defending the framework of classical liberalism is more than adequate to meet our challenges.
Yeah, and by the way, you have actually fought in a war. You've served in the army during a war, unlike many of the people who were involved in this. By the way, here's like a random, almost one-off thought that I was thinking about this whole debate, that you know that we're in the war and that you're being cast as sort of Alexander Kerensky. Right. And the Bolsheviks are saying, you know, we've got to get rid of Alexander Kerensky is not the answer to all this. And do you know, by the way, that Alexander Kerensky lived until 1970 and died in New York? You probably did know that, didn't you?
No, I did not know that. And then I'm going to go ahead and confess even more and say I don't even know who you're talking about.
Okay. All right. See, this is the problem. I do this with all you younger people. No. He was the interim head of the Russian government after the first, you know, the Russian Revolution in 1917 before the Bolsheviks came in. He was sort of the moderate, the social democratic. He was the David French of the Russian Revolution.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. So. You know, part of this, and what happened, of course, was that this thing quickly morphed from being about you and Sohrab, and it was obviously not a personal spat, into this really full-throated rejection of classical liberalism, of the values of the Enlightenment, of the kind of principles of the founding, all the things that I was talking with George Will about. And it really did expose the willingness on the part of folks on the right, particularly the Trumpist right, to reject that, to basically say, yes, we think American conservatism with its classical liberal roots is just not adequate for the fight, and that we are going to begin to sound more like the European types of conservatives, a very,
right,
very different tradition. So at least on one level, this controversy did spark a debate over liberalism versus illiberalism.
Yes.
And that's not a terrible thing.
No. I mean, you know, look, I think that throughout American history, we've had challenges to liberalism. We've had challenges to American class. We've seen illiberal challenges to the principles of the American founding for a long time. And there's no surprise that we have illiberal challenges to liberalism today. I think that what is emerging is that what we used to think of as the, quote, conservative movement, was actually far less united around a certain set of core principles than we previously thought. That's not a news flash in the age of Trump. that's now received conventional wisdom in the age of Trump, that there were major philosophical differences in on the right. And
is a self-evident truth.
Yeah, self-evident. And so part of the problem here is that I think we have sort of two problems. One is we are continually, and I always botch pronouncing this, but catastrophizing the American culture and American political situation. So we're always flight 93-ing it, it's an emergency. We're constantly losing. We lose everywhere. Conservatism conserves nothing, and we have to try radically different measures. And so that's a viewpoint that an awful lot of people have. Now, but the crazy thing is, if you go to a progressive gathering, you will often hear some Flight 93-ism on their side. They're not acting as if they're a triumphant force that's driving all enemies before them. Progressives feel very embattled. And so you'll hear these two competing narratives. And one of the reasons why I think our culture war has become so toxic is both sides think they're losing, and both sides think it's insane for the other side to think it's losing.
This is fascinating. I mean, that is absolutely true. You know, you have the left looks and that power is all in politics, and they see conservatives, commanding the heights there, so therefore they are losing. Conservatives who control most of the arms of government, or at least until recently did, you know, are looking at the culture and education and saying we are clear in religion and that we are clearly losing. We are clearly playing the victim card, and we are in end times as a result of this.
Yes. And every victory is sort of presumed as being a result of the natural order of things, and every defeat is an aspect of the mighty power of the opposition. And you know, I'll freely admit, like I used to have a more tunnel vision view of the culture war. I would sort of, because I was involved in life and religious liberty litigation for years, you know, as a lawyer, you kind of go to where the action is. And so, you know, I'm living my life fighting over these issues where the power of the progressive movement is at its apex. And so you can begin to get that same sense of defeatism. However, you know, we were very fortunate and blessed to win a lot of cases. And so that sort of kept the defeatism at bay. But I like the way Ramesh Panuru, my colleague at National Review, said, and I'm paraphrasing him, but if you look at the big sweep of American culture over the last generation or two, it has become more pro-life, it has become more pro-gun, and it has become more pro-gay. In other words, the culture war is a mixed bag. I mean, there are areas in which conservatives have done well. There are areas in which the progressive left has done well. And the awful lot of it is kind of a seesaw.
Well, on the issue of classical liberalism, and I'll replay the conversation I had with George Will yesterday, because you're absolutely right. What does it mean to be a conservative today? It's very, very difficult. And his answer is that we are conserving the founding and
yes.
the values of the founding. But the values of the founding were classical liberalism. And one thing that I think the whole debate about Frenchism exposed was, in fact, that the fault lines right now in American politics are the attack on classical liberalism. So I'll just say liberalism now. Liberalism from both the right and the left. And
yes.
much of your career has been aimed at fighting the illiberalism of the left. And now we're seeing the rise of the illiberalism of the right. By the way, have you seen, is it Arthur Serwer's piece in The Atlantic on this?
Adam Serwer's, yes.
Adam, I'm sorry. See, this is the problem of not having my phone open. But I mean,
you know the old Bolsheviks. I know the current pundits.
This is great. That's a balance there. But you know, really, you should look up Alexander Kerensky. He's an interesting guy. I was amazed that he lived till 1970. I'm sorry, that was the reason I popped him in, to realize that what must it have been like. You know, you were head of the provisional government in 1917, and then you get kicked out, but you hang around and you see all of this stuff, and of course are forgotten. But I mean, you know, Adam Serwer's point about the abandonment of liberal values and of democracy. I just want to read a little bit. Black Americans did not abandon liberal democracy because of slavery, Jim Crow, and the systematic destruction of whatever wealth they managed to accumulate. Instead, they took up arms in two world wars to defend it. Japanese Americans did not reject liberal democracy because of internment or the racist humiliation of Asian exclusion. They risked life and limb to preserve it. Latinos did not abandon liberal democracy because of Operation Wetback or Proposition 187, or because of a man who won a presidential election on the strength of his hostility toward Latino immigrants. And he points out it's one of those peculiar ironies of American history. The American creed has no more devoted adherents than those who have been historically denied its promises, and no more fair weather friends than those who have taken them for granted. It really is so upside down watching quote-unquote so-called conservatives abandoning those values.
Yeah, it's extremely upside down. And so it's so upside down that I reject the notion that this is what you would call an intramural fight. I don't put myself on the side of any political movement that is fairly characterized as illiberal. That's not my side. my perception of, I would put it this way. So there's sort of two big fights. One is the old fight that we've always had over culture war issues. So it's life, or it's religious liberty, or it's, say, gun rights. These classic culture war issues are something that, you know, I've grown up fighting about. I've fought about my entire professional career. But then there's another emerging fight that is actually shared on the left and the right more broadly, and it's illiberal versus liberal. And you and I both know there are classical liberal folks on the left who are deeply concerned about the rise of illiberalism, especially on campuses and other places. And then there's classical liberals on the right who are deeply concerned about the rise of illiberalism in quote-unquote our own ranks. And what's happening is you're just seeing classic horseshoe theory, where when the extremes tend to move together towards the same, that extremes tend to kind of bend towards each other. And so we've got one battle over issues, but we've got this very deep battle over structure and what is the very nature of our government. And that's the part that George Will is just so eloquent about when he says we're fighting over the American founding.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And that's where the term conservatism, I think, conceals a great deal and has become not terribly descriptive or transparent. What does exactly mean? I mean, you know, Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson think it means one thing. Obviously, you and I think it means something different. But again, the lines that have formed kind of remind us that right now it is liberalism versus illiberalism. And so to think of it in terms of Republican versus Democrat, and I think you already said that, I'm putting in different words, think of it in terms of Republican versus Democrat misses the point, right versus left misses the point. We are right now classical liberals, but we don't want to call ourselves that.
Right.
Well, and actually, there's more clarity and a better, clearer tradition of saying I am a classical liberal because I don't know what the word conservative means right now.
There's a lot of merit to that point. I mean, I think if you're going to sort of drill down, what am I? How would I describe myself? Well, I'm a pro-life classical liberal, for example. That would be. But the problem that we have is there's a huge, vast, vast majority of Americans who don't, if you say the words classical liberal, they don't have the slightest clue what you're talking about, or a small L liberal. They don't have the slightest clue. And so, you know, these words like conservative, which actually have meaning to people in some ways, that's why people are fighting so hard about that, over that label, to own it, because the word conservative in a huge section of the American public has a certain degree of goodwill attached to it.
And ill will.
Yeah, of course. Same with the word progressive. It has a goodwill in some quarters and ill will in others. But the phrase classical liberal, people are just, what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would have preferred going with Whig. But I think there's a branding, even a worse branding problem with that. So I want to come back to this because I told you before we started the podcast, I want to talk about some of the stuff you've been writing about Chick-fil-A and a term that I had not heard of before that you used in a recent column, performative wokeness. And this, again, really does dovetail with what we're talking about. It is the illiberalism from the left. But I had one more question I had to ask you about the whole fight about David Frenchism. And I'm actually really torn on this. And I think by the way, this is an interesting question. And I'm sure you've asked this question, and you and your wife have asked this question over and over again. Why you? No, seriously. Why you? Why not Peter Weiner? Why not against George Willism? Why not against, why you, considering that your credentials as a pro-life warrior are absolutely unchallengeable? I mean, it is, you know, like, well, he's so nice. David, you're nice, but you're not that nice.
I know. It's so funny. I was hanging out in D.C. earlier this week with some of my old colleagues at the Alliance Defending Freedom, where I ran the Center for Academic Freedom for several years, suing universities. And so these are guys who worked as part of my litigation team. I'm hanging out with them. And they said, I read the First Things article, and I did not recognize the person they described. I'm not that nice. I could probably stand to be a lot kinder as a human being. But let me say this. I think here's what I think. For reasons related to the whole Bill Kristol thing in 2016, also to the fact that I'm one of a decreasing number of social conservatives who continue to maintain the same stance about Trump. Because I write regularly at a prominent conservative outlet, because I make arguments in moral terms, which drives a lot of people up the wall, there's a combination of factors that have led me to be a really particular sort of hate object in parts of the MAGA right. They use this term for me, Pastor French, a term that Sohrab used, for example, in the article. And so in that way, if you're wanting to generate MAGA clicks, I'm a decent target for that.
No, I think this is a way of saying, and it's that you pose a greater moral and political challenge to them than some of the rest of us, because you do have that credential. I mean, and you do have that platform. And you know, I don't want people to think that I say something different to your face than I say behind your back, because you know that I've I actually have said this to your face, that I do think that you are one of the most important conservative writers in America. And I think that's what makes you a target, because you have not gone along with the MAGA train. But see, I can say that, you know, it would be somewhat immodest for somebody as nice as you, right?
Well, I thank you for saying that. I think that and there was a good article about this in the Bulwark. I think Jonathan Last wrote it, about what's lurking in the background of all of this isn't just, and we have to be really honest about this, while an illiberal versus liberal argument broke out, that's really, really important. The real issue, the thing that really put this on the front burner in a lot of people's minds was the battle over Trump, and whether or not a pro-life, pro-religious liberty, social conservative Christian should continue to oppose Trump, and that is an extremely contentious issue.
No, and I think that is kind of the dark heart of it, is all of that, which also gives me some hope here that ultimately, if it's about that, then we're not really having an intellectual debate. We're not really having something that's going to persist. Once Donald Trump leaves, you know, they'll find something else to fight about. But I think it's healthy to have the argument, but also understand that the cultists need to wrap themselves into something plausible. But at bottom, they're still personality cultists.
Yeah. Well, you know what we had here, I think what I would call Sohrab's piece deep Christian Trumpism, as opposed to shallow Christian Trumpism. So shallow Christian Trumpism essentially says, look, I know who this guy is. He's not a good guy, but there are very specific things that he can do that are good, and there are very specific things that the Democrats that would do that are bad. And so I'm holding my nose. This is a transactional process. I'm voting for him. So there's not to the extent there's a theological argument here, it's just sort of like over, you know, to what extent is the lesser of two evils a justifiable way to vote, and how do you work within that kind of construct? And that's what I would call shallow Christian Trumpism, Trump as a transactional proposition. They're going to be way beyond that to deep Christian Trumpism, which is Trump is, by his very sort of his very authoritarian nature, is itself a virtue. In other words, they like him because of who he is, not in spite of who he is. And that, I think, is a kind of argument that I think ultimately is, I don't think it will succeed, but to the extent it's made forcefully, I think it's a far more dangerous argument than just the transactional piece of it.
No, I do think you're right about that as well. But by the way, I don't know if you saw that, you know, you've become a meme now on Twitter, and I don't know if you saw what I tweeted about you behind your back last night. I said, this is my most trafficked tweet, by the way, which was, so wait, the USA just lost the NBA title to Canada. I blame David French.
I didn't see, I was off Twitter last night because I couldn't see the game live. So I was trying to, I could only see it, you know, I taped it and could only see it on recording. So I was studiously staying away, but yes, I have become a meme of blaming me for basically everything, and it's really kind of funny.
It is. Okay, so I'm going to switch back to something more serious. And I mentioned this to you before, in the weird world that we all live in, we're sometimes in odd sort of venues, and I'm actually doing the Bill Maher show Friday night when we're taping this, and George Will's actually on the show as well. And one of the topics that he wanted to talk about was Chick-fil-A and the attacks on the left on Chick-fil-A, including the boycotts and the attempts by the San Antonio City Council to block Chick-fil-A from opening a store in its airport. And I went back and I was looking at some of your articles about all of this. And this, again, was one of the stories that has been in the back of my mind. I mean, I've been aware of it. But I'm still shocked by the degree of vindictive, intolerant illiberalism behind the attack on this. And I just want to talk about all of this. I mean, on one level, it is clearly unconstitutional, but I will tell you what shocked me the most. I really was shocked. And you wrote, you know, for people who haven't followed all the latest twists in the chicken wars, the attack in San Diego was San Antonio was really triggered by a piece by Think Progress, lefty group Think Progress, that reported that the Chick-fil-A Foundation donated to the Salvation Army Fellowship of Christian Athletes and a Christian Home for Troubled Youth. That was it. And after that is when the City Council of San Antonio voted to block the restaurant. And I will be honest with you, David. I said, oh, come on. That can't be it. There's got to be something else. I mean, they had to have given money to what? You know, the Westboro Baptist Church. But no, this is what triggered it. The Salvation Army Fellowship of Christian Athletes and a Christian Home for Troubled Youth.
Yes. Wow. Yes, that's exactly right. But I think, you know, the real motivating issue. So all the way back in, what was it, 2011, 2012, when the Chick-fil-A boycott occurred, there were entities affiliated with Chick-fil-A that had given money to more culture war oriented Christian organizations. And I don't think the anger and the fury at Chick-fil-A ever truly fully abated. And so to renew it, it was just a matter of looking for a pretext. And these entities provided the pretext, in part because, mainly because Fellowship of Christian Athletes has a traditional Christian sexual morality requirement for the people who work for the organization. In other words, you know, the same kind of requirements that would apply to somebody who was a pastor at a Baptist church or a pastor at a, you know, Presbyterian church like I attend. So what I think made it particularly pernicious and also particularly alarming to Christians was they're coming after Chick-fil-A not because of it got involved in the culture war, but because it's a foundation donated, and not because it had discriminated against any gay people in employment or service in the restaurant, but because its foundation had given to a standard Christian ministry. In other words, basic, plain vanilla Christian ministry was considered to be so beyond the pale that Chick-fil-A, in spite of as an institution not discriminating against gay customers or gay employees, needed to be punished. And it was an extraordinarily extremist maneuver, truth be told. This was not punishing an organization for discriminating, because there wasn't evidence that it did. This was punishing an organization for giving money to Christian ministries that have the same policies as the vast majority of Christian ministries in the United States of America.
Yeah, and as you've pointed out, just on constitutional grounds, it was clearly unconstitutional to have that kind of viewpoint discrimination. But you also made this other point about what it reflects. This is no longer this top-down imposition by the small secular elite, but it's kind of a grassroots demand from a large segment of the progressive left to do this sort of thing. And that's really what's ominous about this.
Yes, this is the grassroots illiberal left. And if you look at not just the Chick-fil-A issue, but if you look at a lot of the leading religious liberty issues around the country, it is less and less common for you to see this coming down. Well, let me put it this way. In my entire career, I think I maybe sued the federal government on constitutional grounds, religious liberty grounds, maybe once or twice. Whereas the vast, vast, vast majority of my cases were coming from people who were in sort of deep blue spaces around the country, whether it's a university or whether it's a city council in the deep blue area or a civil rights commission in a deep blue area. And this is bubbling up from the grassroots. And so what you have, I think, is you have America's being increasingly divided, sacred, secular. There's a huge number of Americans who are religious, huge number of Americans who are secular. The people who are religious are disproportionately conservative. The people who are secular are disproportionately progressive. And both of those elements, as we just spent a lot of time talking about the illiberal light, right, both of those elements have been infected with a strong strain of illiberalism, and the illiberal left is the one that demands reprisal and punishment and exclusion if you uphold basic Christian orthodoxy.
Okay, so let's talk about this other, what you call the third negative trend, and we're going to get to performative wokeness. And this is, something you talked about this with Jonah Goldberg on his Remnant and podcast, and it's this institutional drive, corporations and governments using their power to wipe out disfavored ideas from the public square. And we're seeing this increasingly. There, you know, all of the CEOs of corporations that signed that open letter about the, was it the Georgia abortion law? So tell me, what is performative wokeness?
Yeah, I think of performative wokeness as something other than, we've heard the term virtue signaling. Virtue signaling is when people sort of ineffectually make, more moral declarations without any weight behind them, just to sort of say, look, I'm a good person. You know, virtue signaling, you see virtue signaling all over Twitter. That's when people jump in on an issue and they just put it out there how great they are, that they're on the right side of an issue. Performative wokeness, I think, is something else. Performative wokeness is when a culture has become so consumed with a sort of woke, illiberal political drive that to be considered for full inclusion in that community, you're going to have to join that culture. You're going to have to become part of, so, you know, I think performative wokeness in many ways is that it's apex in Silicon Valley culture. This is where, you know, there's pressure to join with the larger, cultural movement in things like boycotts, in things like economic reprisals, things that are not just virtue signaling, but have real world impact. And it's sort of a marker of inclusion into this community and into this culture. And you really mainly see it in monocultures. You see it in like Silicon Valley, which is a progressive monoculture, or the higher education establishment. Yep, ideological monoculture. In that circumstance, there's a lot of pressure to join in the reprisal, for example, to join in the illiberal act.
Well, this is what you wrote. In the government context, performatively woke universities and city councils often go well beyond enforcing valid non-discrimination laws and instead wield their financial power and their raw police power like a club, deterring private citizens from participating in the marketplace of ideas for fear of facing government retribution. And then, of course, you have these powerful and wealthy corporations, even wealthy corporations like Chick-fil-A, obviously find in that kind of environment, you find it easier to back down than rather to stand up. Nobody wants to be crossways with all of this. So this becomes very, very stifling.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, another example of sort of performative wokeness in the private sector sphere is, you know, I hear from many people who work in Silicon Valley who are either moderate or right of center, and they genuinely feel if their identity is known, or if they share their true beliefs about issues, which their true beliefs are not at all radical, but quite mainstream conservative, that reprisal will come, that punishment will come. And then the punishment is almost in that culture almost becomes mandatory, that you have to signal your intolerance and act on your intolerance to remain good standing and to, you know, keep good standing in that community.
OK, now here's the frustrating part, and I'm sure that it is exponentially more frustrating for you than for me. Going back to the whole Flight 93 election rhetoric, you know, and the Sora, you know, folks who are saying, look, you know, we need to fight this war because it is a war to the death, because our enemies want to destroy us. They want to kill us. They want to drive us out from the public sector. Of course, you know, using that kind of rhetoric. Unfortunately, stories like this provide them enough plausibility that, yes, because it is true that you do have these, you know, the woke illiberal ideologues who do despise Orthodox Christianity and who do and are,
of course,
setting out to stigmatize them and drive them from the public square and to force them to abandon many of their practices. So there is a plausibility to that argument.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, look, I mean, I know that better than most people, having litigated. I think at one point I had sued more universities on free speech grounds than any other lawyer in the United States. I mean, I know what we're up against, you know. And so, but the thing is, what their argument is you confront illiberalism with illiberalism. my argument is not to deny the existence of illiberalism, but to defend America's principles with America's principles. And what I have found is when you are defending against illiberalism, when you're confronting illiberalism as you model liberalism yourself, appealing to the rule of law, appealing to American constitutional values, you will be surprised at what you can accomplish and who you can persuade. Because one of the hidden realities of my litigation career in colleges is for every school I had to sue to get, say, a Christian group recognized or to get an act of censorship stopped, there were many more that I didn't have to sue. There were many times when we could actually persuade. There was an instance where in the state of California, where, and this was not my direct involvement, but this was the direct involvement of a Christian ministry, where they did not have strong legal recourse to sue their way back into the Cal State system, which is more than a dozen universities. They persuaded their way back into the Cal State system, even in the ideological monoculture of the university. So these folks who say the only way through is to, in essence, become the enemy, to become like the enemy, that's just completely wrong. It's just totally wrong. You defend the founding right, with the principles of the founding.
Well, and also, I mean, this is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of a recognition of reality. These guys, they're not going to win the culture war, the heights of the culture war, this whole idea. What was the language that we will dominate the public square, right, and enjoy the fruits of our victory? Well,
silly.
Sohrab is not going to be running Harvard, Yale, and the University of California system anytime soon. I mean, we're just not going to, you know.
They're not even going to run the Sacramento Public Library that had the drag queen reading hour.
Exactly, which is why sort of mutual tolerance and civility is the best possible solution, which we at least understood at one point. If you're not going, so what is the answer of Frenchism to the drag queen, the drag queen presentation at the Sacramento Public Library?
Well, you know, look, I'm a believer in ordered liberty in this sense. There's two great documents that everyone knows and understands, but two documents that I sort of serve as guiding documents on the principles of the founding for me. One is, of course, the Declaration of Independence. We're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. The other one is this John Adams letter to the Massachusetts militia. And in that letter, he talks about how the government isn't actually strong enough to handle a broken culture. That the Constitution, he says, was made for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the governance of any other. And so what I do is I try to focus on what is our role? The government's prime role is to defend the liberty of its citizens. Not its only role, but its prime role is to defend the liberty of its citizens. But then what is the citizen's role? The citizen's role is to exercise that liberty for virtuous ends. So what that means is we clear the space for the transmission of virtuous ideas and then seek to win the culture through the transmission of ideas, not the imposition of law. Now, there are certain circumstances where the imposition of law is unavoidable. And because of the culture is so, so thoroughly broken. And those are very rare. But in the principal example of that would be the complete collapse of the ideals of the American founding with slavery and Jim Crow. But we're not there. Drag queen reading hour is not there. And so, you know, the question that I would have for Sohrab and others who look at that and say that has to stop. Well, how? Yeah. Federalizing the library, depriving them of the rights of free association, fully understanding that you would then lose your own free association rights? That makes no sense to me.
I was very unclear on exactly what he was recommending there, other than he didn't want the drag queen to be able to have the reading hour. But then when he talks about enjoying the fruits of our dominance of the public square, did he mean that rather than having drag queen reading hour, we would have what mandatory reading of the Stations of the Cross? I mean what exactly was he getting to? I mean,
It's all unclear. It's the only thing that's clear is I'm too weak to fight for whatever they want to create.
Oh, was it this? I almost forgot I had to ask you all of this. The most entertaining attack on you. The most. And you know where I'm going on this one. I love this one. From the editor of First Things, was not content simply to, you know, talk about all these ideas, was to question, like, how dare David French, raise questions about the character of our sterling president of the United States, including the fact that he posed on the for a cover of a Playboy magazine, when you, David French, watch Game of Thrones, openly watch Game of Thrones, in which there are apparently many naked breasts.
You know,
and he counted them.
And he kept going and going. And to this day would say, well, I'm a defender of smut. I mean, look, the idea that a person, because Game of Thrones is basically like an R-rated movie. The idea that you cannot critique a person guilty of all of the things that Trump has done, including appearing in softcore porn movies that Playboy has put out, not as a performer, thank goodness, but in segments of those in those movies, that you cannot critique those things if you watch R-rated movies might be the equivalent of R-rated movies might be one of the most absurd contributions, and I use that term loosely, to this debate I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was like the deep point that he was making, which turns out to be a very, very silly point, and one would refer him to many of Shakespeare's plays or to some of the goings on in the Old Testament, but that would require actually engaging the argument of somebody who actually tallies up the number of naked breasts in a TV show. I mean, that's what I think the folks on Twitter would call a self-own.
Well, and this is part of the against Frenchism aspect of this that is just against me. You know, it's just how can I find a way to pick at him and to insult him? And that was one of the disappointing aspects of Sohrab's original article, quite frankly. But it's also the way, as I said, that's a great way to get MAGA clicks from certain segments of the MAGA right.
But this is also part of our culture, the degree which we very rarely have serious debates about ideas and how much of the back and forth is ad hominem, as if the ad hominem argument has just completely shoved out substantive debate in many circles. Obviously, and I'm not everyone. I mean, there are still, you know, serious people writing serious articles, but the dominant culture, whether you're talking about on Fox News or on talk radio or in much of social media, is this belief that I don't actually have to confront your ideas in any substantive way. I'm just going to find something about you I don't like, and I'm going to zap you for that. And this is part of the coarsening of the public dialogue. Donald Trump didn't create it, but he sure has been an accelerant.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, and you see this all the time. I'll write about something and I'll make an argument, and I try to use facts and reason and logic. I try as much as possible to be as accurate as I humanly can. I want to present an argument to the public square, and then you'll see immediately people, they won't even read it. They'll just say, well, he doesn't like Trump. And so what people are looking for is they're looking for a shorthand reason to disregard something that is contrary to, you know, that's to disregard uncomfortable truths or to embrace embrace things that they shouldn't embrace. And so that's the focusing of your anger around human beings at the expense of advancing ideas. And that's the hallmark of negative polarization in this country. It is the reality that a lot of people are Democrats, not because they love Democratic ideas, but because they really despise Republicans. And lots of people are Republicans, not because they love Republican ideas, but they really despise Democrats. And I think Exhibit A of that was 2016, because I think the only thing Trump had ever been consistent on politically for more than a few minutes was the trade issue. I mean, going all the way back to the 80s, he was, you know, sounding the alarm on trade. And I think the only thing that Hillary Clinton had been consistent on in her career was abortion. But beyond that, those are two of the most malleable politicians in American history. They'd been on every side of every issue. And yet their race was one of the most intense and vicious that I've seen in my adult lifetime. These politicians were not ideologues. But they loathed each other and they loathed the people that they led. And that is what that ethos is transmitting itself far beyond the personalities in a political race and into the entire cultural conversation.
Again, it does not leave any room for nuance or independent thought. But you're right. I think these shorthand ad hominem attacks are also kind of the permission to stop thinking. It's sort of the relief that I don't have to read and think, and I don't need to run the risk of perhaps having, you know, inconvenient doubts introduced that would you know, shatter my alliance with the tribe. David French, obviously the bastards are not getting you down. I mean, I think that's the bottom line here, right?
I'm still going. I'm still tweeting. Still writing.
Okay. As long as, because every once in a while there'll be somebody able to go, I'm getting off Twitter, and that feels like a surrender, like a little death. Like, okay, I give up. Even though I think it's always a good life choice to get off social media. But as long as the bastards have not gotten you down, this is good news. Thank you for spending so much time with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Much appreciated.
And thank you for listening again to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, or maybe just Monday, and we'll do this all over again.